Once a week, there was a movie night on the aft deck with a recently released film flown in. Popcorn was made, a screen erected, and when everyone was settled, Hubbard would descend from the prom deck, resplendent in his Commodore's uniform, with Mary Sue and the children in tow. In the interest of public relations, Hubbard staged free concerts at various ports of call, using the ship's ragtag band, the Apollo Stars. He wanted to revolutionize music and composed original songs for the band to play. He started a modern dance troupe as well. Quentin wanted to join the dancers, but his father sternly told him that he had other plans for him. By 1974, Hubbard had decided that his two oldest children by Mary Sue, Diana, 22, and Quentin, 20, were to take over the major management and technology functions of Scientology. Diana was enthusiastic. She had been the lieutenant commander since the age of 16 and was often at her father's side. But everyone knew that Quentin's great ambition was to fly. His cabin was full of model airplanes, suspended from the ceiling with dental floss, and books about flying. He was often seen weaving along the deck with his arms outstretched, making engine noises, completely absorbed in being a plane. Jim Dinkalsi, the medical officer who was still beached in Madeira, learned that the Apollo was headed in his direction. By now he had made friends with many of the local people, and he was surprised to learn from them that the Apollo was widely suspected of being a spy ship for the CIA. Footnote. The CIA at the time was taking note of Hubbard mainly through newspaper clippings. There is no indication that Hubbard or members of his organization have been engaged in intelligence or security matters, an agency dispatch notes. Rather, Hubbard appears to be a shrewd businessman who has parlayed his Scientology religion into a multi-million-dollar business by taking advantage of that portion of society prone to fall for such gimmicks. Scientology / L. Ron Hubbard, CIA Dispatch, March 18, 1971. End footnote. He sent telexes warning the ship that it would be better to avoid Madeira, but Hubbard came anyway. Soon after the Apollo docked, a mob arrived and began stoning the ship. Hubbard ordered fire hoses turned on the crowd, which further infuriated them. There were motorcycles belonging to crew members and two of Hubbard's cars, which had been offloaded onto the pier. The mob shoved them all into the harbor, then loosened the moorings so that the ship drifted offshore. Mary Sue and some other members of the ship's company were stranded in town and had to be rescued by the local authorities. Quentin returned to the ship in bad shape. He had taken an overdose of pills in a failed suicide attempt. After his stomach was pumped at a local hospital, he was brought back to the ship, pale and weak, and put in isolation in his cabin, guarded night and day, becoming the second person to undergo the introspection rundown. Suzette was the only one to visit him. He looked like a broken doll. Quentin was now 20 years old, popular and free-spirited, but in many ways still a soft-spoken, dreamy boy. Although he was small like his mother and had her coloring, in other respects he bore a strong resemblance to his father. His facial features were almost an exact match, almond-shaped eyes under low, reddish brows, protuberant lips, and a deep cleft in the chin. Even though Quentin became one of the highest-rated auditors in the Sea Org, his father was constantly disappointed in his performance. "You have to improve," he barked at Quentin in front of the other auditors. "It doesn't matter that you're a Hubbard." Quentin would sit there and smile, seemingly unfazed, as the others cringed for him. Privately, he confided, "Daddy doesn't love me anymore." Eventually, Hubbard sentenced Quentin to the Rehabilitation Project Force. His twin on the RPF was Monica Pignatti, an auditor in training at age 21. As they practiced auditing each other, they became close. Quentin sneaked some peanut butter from the family pantry and shared it with Monica. They made up skits and played with his tape recorder. They never became intimate. Quentin told her that he had once become sexually involved with a woman, but when his father found out, she was sent off the ship. He knew that people regarded him as a homosexual, he said, but that was only something he told other women on the ship who were after him because he was Hubbard's son. Hubbard set a new course, due west, toward America. The destination was Charleston, South Carolina. The crew were thrilled that they would be returning to the States, only to be crestfallen when a message arrived from the Guardian's office just as the ship was approaching port, alerting Mary Sue that agents from U.S. Customs, Immigration, Coast Guard, DEA, and U.S. Marshals were waiting for them to dock, plus 180 IRS agents waiting to impound the ship. The federal agents had a subpoena to depose Hubbard in a civil tax case in Hawaii. A Scientologist on shore realized what was happening when he was blocked from entering the dock area. He sent a pizza to a radio operator with a message inside to send to the ship. Hubbard was just 5 miles offshore, but he suddenly broadcasted a new course over the radio, due north for Halifax, Nova Scotia, then turned sharply south and headed to the Bahamas. Hubbard was 64 years old in 1975 as the Apollo began its circumnavigation of the Caribbean. He weighed 260 pounds. He was still meticulously groomed, but his teeth and fingers were darkly stained from constant smoking. He was on the run from the courts, fearful of being discovered, marked by age, and visibly in decline. In Curaçao, he suffered a small stroke and spent several weeks in a local hospital. It was becoming clear that life at sea posed a real danger for a man in such frail health. His crew rationalized his obvious decline by saying that his body was battered by the research he was undertaking and the volumes of suppression aimed at him. "He's risking his life for us," they told each other. By now, the rumor about the CIA spy ship had spread all over the Caribbean, making the Scientologists unwelcome or at least under suspicion everywhere they went. They were kicked out of Barbados, Curaçao, and Jamaica. Moreover, the Arab oil embargo had sent the price of fuel skyrocketing, so the roving life was getting too expensive to support. It was time to come ashore. From the Apollo, Hubbard sent a couple of delegations to locate a land base for Scientology, specifically a town that the church could take over. One team arrived in the Florida retirement community of Clearwater, a resonant name for Scientologists, to look over a dowdy downtown hotel called the Fort Harrison, which had earned a place in popular history when Mick Jagger wrote the lyrics for Satisfaction beside the swimming pool in 1965. Hubbard purchased the Fort Harrison and a bank building across the street using a false front called the United Churches of Florida, which he calculated would not disturb the staid moral climate of the conservative community. When the mayor of Clearwater, Gabriel Cazares, raised questions about the extraordinary security that suddenly appeared around the church buildings, Guardian's office operatives tried to frame him in a staged hit-and-run accident and planted false marriage documents in Tijuana, Mexico, to make it appear that Cazares was a bigamist. Several months passed before the flabbergasted citizens discovered that Clearwater had become the flag land base for the Church of Scientology. Scientologists would simply call it FLAG. Hubbard had been keeping a low profile in a condominium nearby, but in January 1976, his tailor leaked the news to a St. Petersburg Times reporter that the leader of Scientology was in town. As soon as Hubbard heard this, he grabbed $25,000 in cash, collected Kimma Douglas, his medical officer, and her husband, Michael, and lit out in his Cadillac for Orlando. The next day, he announced that they were going to his old hideout in Queens. The Cadillac was too conspicuous, so he sent Michael out to buy a nondescript Chevy hatchback. The trip to New York took 3 days, with Hubbard smoking continuously in the back seat and crying, "There they are! They're after us!" every time he saw a police car. When they finally arrived, Kimma judged Queens too depressing, so they turned around and went to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, agents from the Guardian's office raced to Southern California to look for remote properties where Hubbard could operate more discreetly. Soon, Hubbard and Mary Sue, along with her Tibetan terriers Yama and Tashi, set up in their new quarters on 3 large properties in La Quinta, California, a desert town south of Palm Springs. Hubbard grew a goatee and let his hair hang down to his shoulders. He looked like Wild Bill Hickok, one Sea Org member recalled. He kept a hopped-up Plymouth and $500,000 in cash ready for a quick getaway. Left behind in Clearwater and without his father hovering over him, Quentin became freer and more assertive. He befriended an older Scientologist from New Zealand, Grace Alp, who arrived at Flag Base with terminal cancer. She looked like a witch with gray hair and a hooked nose, like she was in a haunted house, said Karen de la Carrier, who was Alp's auditor. During auditing sessions, Alp would just rock back and forth, crying, "I'm going to die! I'm going to die!" Everyone kept a distance from the woman except Quentin, who took over her case. He actually let her move into his room and sleep in his bed while he slept on the floor. Then he made a catastrophic mistake. Dennis Ehrlich, the chief cramming officer at Flag, who supervised the upper-level auditors, noted jarring disparities between Quentin's upbeat reports on Alp and her glaring lack of progress. Ehrlich called Quentin in for a meeting. Quentin, or Q, as his friends called him, was 22 at the time, Ehrlich later wrote. He looked 15 and acted 5. During the interview, Quentin continually zoomed his hand through the air and made airplane noises. He calmly told Ehrlich that he had falsely reported the results. "I think a lot of my father's stuff doesn't work," he said, "so I false report whenever I need to. Personally, I think my father's crazy." Not only was Quentin the founder's son, he was also one of the highest-ranked auditors in the church, and yet he had committed an unpardonable offense. Ehrlich had no choice but to tell him that he would have to surrender all of his training certificates and start the entire Scientology series all over again. Years of work. Quentin seemed completely nonchalant. What happened after this is full of contradiction and mystery. Tracy Ekstrand, who was Quentin's steward, set a cookie on his bedside table that evening. It was still there the next night. The bed had not been slept in. Ehrlich was expecting Quentin to show up to go over his new training program, but he didn't appear that day or the next. Word went out that Quentin had blown. In other words, he had fled. He left a confused note full of references to UFOs, saying that he was going to Area 51, the secret air base north of Las Vegas, Nevada, where the CIA has developed spy planes. In popular culture, Area 51 was said to be where an alien spacecraft was stored. Quentin had only just learned to drive a car in the parking garage of the condominium where he accidentally ran into the wall with such force that the entire building registered the shock. He was scarcely qualified to drive all the way across the country by himself. Quentin had repeatedly requested a leave to take flying lessons, but Hubbard was convinced that Quentin couldn't be trusted to fly a plane under any circumstances. Frantic, Mary Sue dispatched 300 Guardian's office operatives to find him. Weeks passed. as the Scientologists checked hotels and flying schools in multiple states. A cover story was put out that Quentin had been given flying lessons as a present from his parents, and he was driving to California to fulfill his lifelong ambition. Quentin was indeed headed for Nevada. It was one of the very few times in his life when he was on his own and free. He stopped in St. Louis on his drive west and took a VIP tour of the giant aerospace manufacturer McDonnell Douglas. He was enthralled by the display of aircraft and artifacts of the Mercury and Gemini space programs. He even got a ride in one of the company's business jets. He was so happy, Cindy Mallion, who had lunch with him that afternoon, recalled. He was just beaming. But only a few days later, Las Vegas police were trying to identify a slight young man with blonde hair and a reddish mustache who had been discovered comatose in a car parked on Sunset Road facing the end of the runway of McCarran Airport. He was naked. He was 5 feet 1 inch tall and weighed just over 100 pounds. There were no identifying marks on his body and no personal identification. The license plates had been removed. The engine of the white Pontiac was still running when he was discovered. The windows were rolled up, and a vacuum tube led from the exhaust through the passenger's vent window. 2 weeks later, on November 12, 1976, the young man died without regaining consciousness. Las Vegas police were finally able to connect the Pontiac with Quentin through a Florida smog sticker and the vehicle identification number. An agent from the Guardian's office came into Hubbard's office in La Quinta as he was having breakfast and handed him the report on Quentin's death. "That little shit has done it to me again," Hubbard cried. He threw the report at Kimma Douglas and ordered her to read it. The report said Quentin had died of asphyxiation of carbon monoxide. It also noted that there was semen in his rectum. When Hubbard told Mary Sue that Quentin was dead, she screamed for 10 minutes. For months, she was disconsolate, hiding behind dark glasses. Everyone knew that Quentin was her favorite. A spokesman for the church said that Quentin had been on vacation. Meantime, Mary Sue arranged for 3 further autopsies to be performed. In the last one, the cause of death was said to be unknown. She put out the word that he had died of encephalitis. Hubbard himself was convinced that Quentin was murdered as a way of getting at him. Part 2. Hollywood. Chapter 4. The Faith Factory. Despite its reputation for carnality and narcissism, Los Angeles has always been a spawning ground for new religions. In 1906, a one-eyed black preacher named William Seymour set up a church in a livery stable on Azusa Street and began a revival that lasted for 3 years. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims came to hear his message. Stigmatized as holy rollers and decried because of their interracial worship, Seymour's followers gave birth to the Pentecostal movement, which quickly spread across the world, becoming an enduring force in modern Christianity. In 1912, a theosophist colony called Crotona took root just below the current Hollywood sign, where the hills were said to be magnetically impregnated. An organization called Mighty I Am Presence began in Los Angeles and expanded all across America, gaining about 1 million followers by 1938. The founders were Guy and Edna Ballard, who claimed to be able to communicate with ascended masters. Guy wrote a popular book titled Unveiled Mysteries, in which he related his travels through the stratosphere, visiting great cities of antiquity and unearthing buried loot, much as Hubbard attempted to do several decades later. Writers William Butler Yeats, D.H. Lawrence, Christopher Isherwood, and Aldous Huxley passed through the city, all drawn by its reputation as a center for spiritual innovation. One of the most famous preachers in American history, Amy Semple McPherson, built the Angelus Temple near Echo Park in 1923, where she married Pentecostalism with Hollywood theatricality. She created sets for her sermons on a stage designed for her by Charlie Chaplin, who may have been one of her secret Hollywood paramours. Milton Berle claimed to be another. Anticipating the garb of Hubbard and the Sea Org, McPherson liked to dress in an admiral's uniform while her disciples wore nautical outfits. As a teenager, Anthony Quinn played the saxophone in the church and translated for Sister Amy when she preached in Mexican neighborhoods. After he became a movie star, Quinn would compare her to the great actresses he worked with, including Ingrid Bergman and Katharine Hepburn. They all fell short of that first electric shock Amy Semple McPherson produced in me. And so when the Church of Scientology was officially founded in Los Angeles in February 1954 by several of Hubbard's devoted followers, there was already a history of religious celebrities and celebrity religions. The cultivation of famous people, or people who aspired to be famous, was a feature of Hubbard's grand design. He foresaw that the best way of promoting Scientology as a ladder to enlightenment was to court celebrities, whom he defined as any person important enough in his field, or an opinion leader, or his entourage, business associates, family, or friends, with particular attention to the arts, sports, and management and government. It was not surprising that Hubbard would hire as his personal assistant Richard DeMille, son of the legendary producer and director Cecil B. DeMille, who had started Paramount Pictures and was in some ways responsible for the creation of Hollywood itself. In 1955, a year after the church's founding, an editorial in Ability, a publication affiliated with the church, urged Scientologists to recruit celebrities. A long list of desirable prospects followed, including Marlena Dietrich, Walt Disney, Jackie Gleason, John Ford, Bob Hope, and Howard Hughes. "If you want one of these celebrities as your game, write us at once, so the notable will be yours to hunt without interference," the editorial promised. "If you bring one of them home, you will get a small plaque as your reward." Author William Burroughs and actor Stephen Boyd were drawn into the church in its early days. Scientology was a religion rather perfectly calibrated for its time and place, since American culture, and soon the rest of the world, was bending increasingly toward the worship of celebrity, with Hollywood as its chief shrine. At the end of the 60s, the church established its first celebrity center in Hollywood. There are now satellites in Paris, Vienna, Dusseldorf, Munich, Florence, London, New York, Las Vegas, and Nashville. The object was to make celebrities even better known and to help their careers with Scientology, Hubbard wrote. "By accomplishing this major target, I know that celebrity centers can take over the whole acting artist's world." Hubbard was particularly interested in stars whose careers had crested but still had enough luster that they could be rehabilitated and made into icons of Scientology. The prototype was Gloria Swanson, one of the greatest stars of the silent movie era who personified the lavish glamour of that era. Although she never regained the international fame she had known before the talkies, she continued acting on television and in occasional movies, most memorably as Norma Desmond in the 1950 classic Sunset Boulevard. Hubbard's top auditor, Peggy Conway, a South African entertainer, ardently cultivated Swanson, calling her "my adorable glory" in her many letters to the star, although she saves her highest praise for Hubbard, who was also her auditor. "The master did his Sunday best on me," she wrote Swanson in 1956. "He never went to bed. We talked the clock around, day after day, night after night. I was 6,000 light-years above Arcturus. What a genius is our great Red Father! A constant stream of aspiring young actors, writers, and directors came to Hollywood with common dreams, trying to leverage whatever ability or looks they might have in a market already overwhelmed by beautiful and talented and chronically unemployed young people. Many of them were rather poorly educated. They had left school to gamble on stardom, but they were smart, talented, and desperately ambitious. Scientology promised these neophytes an entry into the gated community of celebrity. The church claimed to have a method for getting ahead. Just as enticing was the whispered assertion that a network of Scientologists existed at the upper levels of the entertainment industry, eager to advance like-minded believers. A claim that never had much to support it, but was not entirely untrue. Scientology was a small but growing subculture in the Hollywood studios. Kirstie Alley was an aspiring actress from Wichita who left the University of Kansas in her sophomore year, then struggled with an addiction to cocaine. She says that a single auditing session cured her habit. "Without Scientology, I would be dead," she declared. The testimonials of such celebrities would lead many curious seekers to follow their example. Posters with the faces of television and movie stars were placed outside Scientology churches and missions saying, "I am a Scientologist. Come in and find out why." In the Hollywood trade magazine Variety, Scientology offered courses promising to help neophyte actors increase your self-confidence and make it in the industry. Scientologists stood outside Central Casting, where actors sign up for roles as extras, passing out flyers for workshops on how to find an agent or get into the Screen Actors Guild. Courses at the Celebrity Center focused on communication and self-presentation skills, which were especially prized in the entertainment industry. The drills and training routines would have felt somewhat familiar to anyone who had done scene work in an acting class. Many actors, at once insecure but competitive by nature, were looking for an advantage which Scientology promised to give them. The fact that anyone was interested in them at all must have come as a welcome surprise. Others who passed through Scientology at the same time as Paul Haggis were actors Tom Berenger, Christopher Reeve, and Anne Francis, and musicians Lou Rawls, Leonard Cohen, Sonny Bono, and Gordon Lightfoot. None stayed long. Jerry Seinfeld took a communication course, which he still credits with helping him as a comedian. Elvis Presley bought some books as well as some services he never actually availed himself of. Rock Hudson visited the Celebrity Center, but stormed out when his auditor had the nerve to tell him he couldn't leave until he finished with his session, although the matinee idol had run out of time on his parking meter. The exemplary figure that Hubbard sought eluded capture. Very early one morning in July 1977, the FBI, having been tipped off about Operation Snow White, carried out raids on Scientology offices in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., carting off nearly 50,000 documents. One of the files was titled Operation Freakout. It concerned the treatment of Paulette Cooper, the journalist who had published an exposé of Scientology, The Scandal of Scientology, 6 years earlier. After having been indicted for perjury and making bomb threats against Scientology, Cooper had gone into a deep depression. She stopped eating. At one point, she weighed just 83 pounds. She considered suicide. Finally, she persuaded a doctor to give her sodium pentothal, or truth serum, and question her under the anesthesia. The government was sufficiently impressed that the prosecutor dropped the case against her, but her reputation was ruined. She was broke, and her health was uncertain. The day after the FBI raid on the Scientology headquarters, Cooper was flying back from Africa on assignment for a travel magazine when she read a story in the International Herald Tribune about the raid. One of the files the federal agents discovered was titled Operation Freakout. The goal of the operation was to get Cooper incarcerated in a mental institution or jail. One of the doors the federal agents opened during the raid in Los Angeles led to the darkened basement of the old Cedars of Lebanon Hospital on Fountain Avenue, newly christened as Scientology's Advanced Org Building. There were no lights, so the heavily armed agents made their way down the stairs with flashlights. They found a warren of small cubicles, each occupied by half a dozen people dressed in black boiler suits and wearing filthy rags around their arms to indicate their degraded status. Altogether, about 120 people were huddled in the pitch-black basement, serving time in the Rehabilitation Project Force. The ranks of the RPF had expanded, along with the church's need for cheap labor to renovate its recently purchased buildings in Hollywood. The federal agents had no idea what they were seeing. Within moments, a representative of the church's guardian's office arrived and began shouting at the agents that they were exceeding the limits of their search warrants. Seeing that the Sea Org members posed no threat to them, the agents shrugged and moved on. It is instructive to realize that none of the Sea Org members consigned to the RPF dungeon took the opportunity to escape. If the FBI had bothered to interrogate them, it's unlikely that any of them would have said that they were there against their will. Most of them believed that they were there by mistake, or that they deserved their punishment and would benefit by the work and study they were prescribed. Even those who had been physically forced into the RPF were not inclined to leave. Despite federal laws against human trafficking and unlawful imprisonment, the FBI never opened the door on the RPF again. Jesse Prince, one of the very few black members of the Sea Org, was among those being punished. He had been attracted to Scientology by the beautiful girls and the promise of superhuman powers. He recalls being told he would learn to levitate, travel through time, control the thoughts of others, and have total command over the material universe. In 1976, when he signed up for the Sea Org, Scientology had just purchased the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, part of the real estate empire that the church was acquiring in Hollywood, along with the Chateau Elysee and the old Wilcox Hotel, which functioned as Sea Org berthing. The hospital was a mess. There were leftover medical devices and body parts in laboratory jars. There was even a corpse in the basement morgue. The Sea Org crew slaved to convert the hospital into a dormitory and offices. One night, Prince was awakened after an hour of sleep and ordered to report to a superior who chewed him out for slacking off. Prince had had enough. "Fuck you, I'm out of here," he said. His superior told him he wasn't going anywhere. "He snapped his fingers and six people came and put me in a room," Prince recalled. "I was literally incarcerated." It was March 1977. Prince was placed in the RPF with 200 other Sea Org members doing heavy labor and studying Hubbard's spiritual technology. He would be held there for 18 months. "They told me the only way to get out is to learn this tech to a T and then be able to apply it." The question posed by Prince's experience in the RPF is whether or not he was brainwashed. It is a charge often leveled at Scientologists, although social scientists have long been at war with each other over whether such a phenomenon is even possible. The decade of the 1950s, when Scientology was born, was a time of extreme concern, even hysteria, about mind control. Robert J. Lifton, a young American psychiatrist, began studying victims of what Chinese communists called thought reform, which they were carrying out in prisons and revolutionary universities during the Maoist era. It was one of the greatest efforts to manipulate human behavior ever attempted. In 1949, a number of Americans and Europeans who had been imprisoned during the Maoist Revolution emerged from their cells apparently converted to communism. Then, during the Korean War, several United Nations soldiers captured by Chinese troops defected to the enemy. Some American soldiers among them went on camera to denounce capitalism and imperialism with apparent sincerity. It was a stunning ideological betrayal. To explain this phenomenon, an American journalist and CIA operative, Edward Hunter, coined the term brainwashing. Hunter described robotic agents with glassy eyes like zombies or the products of demon possession. A popular novel, The Manchurian Candidate, published in 1959, and a film of the same name that came out 3 years later, capitalized on this conception of brainwashing as being the total surrender of free will through coercive forms of persuasion. Lifton's early work on thought reform has become the basis for much of the scholarship on the subject since then. Lifton defined thought reform as having two basic elements: confession, which is the renunciation of past evil, and re-education, which in China meant refashioning an individual in the communist image. Behind ideological totalism lies the ever-present human quest for the omnipotent guide, for the supernatural force, political party, philosophical ideas, great leader, or precise science that will bring ultimate solidarity to all men and eliminate the terror of death and nothingness, Lifton observes. In facing the commonplace charge that psychiatry, or the Marines, or Catholic schools all engage in forms of brainwashing, Lifton developed a set of criteria to identify a totalistic environment and contrasted these with more open approaches to reshaping human behavior. The totalist paradigm begins with shutting off the individual's access to the outside world so that his perceptions of reality can be manipulated without interference. The goal at this stage is to provoke expectable patterns of behavior that will appear to arise spontaneously, adding to the impression of omniscience on the part of the controlling group. Those who are involved in the manipulation are guided by a sense of higher purpose that permits them, actually compels them, to set aside ordinary feelings of human decency in order to accomplish their great mission. Those who are being manipulated may come to endorse the goals and means of the group, as Prince did, or simply abandon the will to resist. In either case, the individual is robbed of the chance for independent action or self-expression. Because the moral climate is entirely controlled by the group, the sins that one is made to confess function as pledges of loyalty to the ideals of the movement. The repetitive nature of these confessions inevitably turns them into performances. When the treasury of real sins is emptied, new ones may be coined to satisfy the incessant demands of the inquisitors. In Scientology, one can conveniently reach into previous existences to produce an endless supply of misdeeds. Lifton points out that in totalist hands, confession is used to exploit vulnerabilities rather than to provide the solace or forgiveness that therapy and religion seek to provide. The paradoxical result can be the opposite of total exposure. Secrets proliferate, and doubts about the movement go underground. The dogma of the group is promoted as scientifically incontestable. In fact, truer than anything any human being has ever experienced. Resistance is not just immoral, it is illogical and unscientific. In order to support this notion, language is constricted by what Lifton calls the thought-terminating cliché. The most far-reaching and complex of human problems are compressed into brief, highly reductive, definitive-sounding phrases, easily memorized and easily expressed, he writes. These become the start and finish of any ideological analysis. For instance, the Chinese communists dismissed the quest for individual expression and the exploration of alternative ideas as examples of bourgeois mentality. In Scientology, terms such as suppressive person and potential trouble source play a similar role of declaring allegiance to the group and pushing discussion off the table. The Chinese communists divided the world into the people, the peasantry, the petite bourgeoisie, and the reactionaries, or lackeys of imperialism, landlords and capitalists, who were essentially non-people. In a similar manner, Hubbard distinguished between Scientologists and WOGs. The word is a derogatory artifact of British imperialism when it was used to describe dark-skinned peoples, especially South Asians. Hubbard appropriated the slur, which he said stood for worthy Oriental gentleman. To him, a WOG represented a common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill, garden-variety humanoid, an individual who is not present as a spirit. Those who are within the group are made to strive for a condition of perfection that is unattainable, the ideal communist state, for instance, or the clearing of the planet by Scientology. When a pre-clear voices a criticism of Scientology or expresses a desire to leave the church, the auditor's response is to discover the crimes that the client has committed against the group. In Scientology jargon, those crimes are called overts and withholds. An overt is an action taken against the moral code of the group, and a withhold is an overt action that the person is refusing to acknowledge. Hubbard explained that the only reason a person would want to leave Scientology is because he has committed a crime against the group. Paradoxically, this is because humanity is basically good. He wants to separate himself from the others in order to protect the group from his own bad behavior. In order to save the pre-clear from his self-destructive thoughts, the E-meter is used in a security check, sec check, to probe for other thoughts or actions. For extreme cases, Hubbard developed what he called the Johannesburg confessional list. The questions include, have you ever stolen anything? Have you ever blackmailed anybody? Have you ever been involved in an abortion? There are further questions asking if the respondent has ever sold drugs, committed adultery, practiced homosexuality, had sex with a family member or a person of another race. It winds up by inquiring, have you ever had unkind thoughts about LRH? Are you upset about this confessional list? The result of the sec check procedure is that the person expressing doubts about the church is steered into thinking about his own faults that led him to question Scientology in the first place. In the Chinese communist example, Lifton points out, the combination of enforced logic and cliched discourse creates a kind of melodrama in which formulaic thoughts and handicapped language substitute for real emotions and complex understandings of human nature. Once inside the powerful logic of the group, one drifts further and further from the shore of common understanding. According to Lifton, factors such as these award the group life and death authority over individual members. And yet, despite the communists' absolute control of the environment, of the 40 victims that Lifton studied, only 3 were apparent converts to the ideology. That figure has been used to discredit the notion of brainwashing, although Lifton himself later said that he was impressed by the extent to which minds could be altered and, truth, blurred to the point of near extinction. The CIA, alarmed by the reputed success of Chinese indoctrination, started its own research into mind control through a program called MKUltra. In the mid-1950s, the agency began funding Dr. Ewan Cameron, a Scottish-born American citizen who was then directing the Allen Memorial Institute at McGill University in Montreal. Cameron was one of the most eminent psychiatrists of his time, Earlier in his career, he had been a part of the Nuremberg Tribunal that examined the atrocious human experiments of Nazi doctors. Later, he became president of the American Psychiatric Association, the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and, when the CIA stumbled onto his work, president of the World Psychiatric Association. Cameron hoped to cure mental illness by eliminating painful memories and reordering the personality through positive suggestion. The agency's goal was somewhat different, of course. The stated reason was to uncover effective methods of mind control and then train American soldiers in ways of resisting such efforts. The CIA eventually destroyed the files of the MKUltra program, saying that it had acquired no useful information. But the real intention of the agency may have been to learn scientific ways of extracting information from unwilling subjects. After 9/11, documents emerging from the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base showed that the methods used by U.S. interrogators to question al-Qaeda suspects were based on Chinese communist techniques. The methods that Cameron used to erase his patients' memories certainly meet the definition of torture. Electroshock therapy was administered to break the patterns of personality. Up to 360 shocks were administered in a single month in order to make the subject hypersuggestible. On top of that, powerful drugs, uppers, downers, and hallucinogens, were fed to the incapacitated patients to increase their disorientation. According to author Naomi Klein, who wrote about these experiments in The Shock Doctrine, when Cameron finally believed he had achieved the desired blank slate, he placed the patients in isolation and played tape-recorded messages of positive reinforcement, such as, "You are a good mother and wife, and people enjoy your company." Some patients were put into an insulin coma to keep them from resisting. In that state, they were forced to listen to such mantras up to 20 hours a day. In one case, Cameron played a message continuously for more than 100 days. Cameron was a perfect archetype for the evil that science has done in the name of mental health, and in the minds of many Scientologists, his work justifies the campaign the church has waged against psychiatry. It is intriguing to compare these actual experiments with Hubbard's mythic vision of Xenu and the R6 implants, in which the disembodied thetans were forced to sit in front of movie screens for 36 days of programming at the hands of psychiatrists. Although it is unlikely that Hubbard would have known about MKUltra when it was going on, he had become fascinated by the mind control scare. In 1955, he distributed a pamphlet, which he probably wrote, called Brainwashing, a synthesis of the Russian textbook on psychopolitics. For some former Scientologists, brainwashing provides a codex for Hubbard's grand scheme. There is an eerie mirroring of the techniques described in the pamphlet and some Scientology practices, especially those put into effect in the RPF. The pamphlet opens with what is claimed to be a purloined speech given by Lavrenti Beria, the head of the Soviet secret police under Joseph Stalin, to American students studying at Lenin University on the subject of psychopolitics. The term is defined as the art and science of asserting and maintaining dominion over the thoughts and loyalties of individuals, bureaus, and masses, and the effecting of the conquest of enemy nations through mental healing. The text specifies how to realign the goals of the individual with those of the group. The first task is to undermine the ability of the person to act and to trust himself. Next, his loyalty to his family is destroyed by breaking the economic dependency of the family unit, lessening the value of marriage, and turning over the raising of children to the state or the group. The individual's trust and affection for his friends is shattered by anonymous reports to the authorities, supposedly from people close to him. Ultimately, all other emotional claims on the person have been broken. Only the state or the group remains. A psychopolitician must work hard to produce the maximum chaos in the fields of mental healing, Beria says in his introductory speech. You must labor until we have dominion over the minds and bodies of every important person in your nation. From the perspective of those social scientists who believe that brainwashing is a myth or a fraud that has been used to denigrate new religious movements, including Scientology, Jesse Prince must already have been a convert or close to one before he went into the RPF. Although he says he was attracted to the church largely because of the girls, he was aware of the rigors of the Sea Org before he joined it. Perhaps, like the three victims of Chinese communist thought reform that Lifton termed apparent converts, Prince was predisposed to be a part of a totalitarian movement because of his own psychological need to conform or to be a part of a polarized system that separates all humanity into the saved and the damned. Such persons, the theory goes, are reared in either chaotic or extremely authoritarian homes. They have conflicted images of themselves as being at once extremely good and extremely bad. This is particularly true in adolescence, when identities are still volatile. Prince didn't need to be brainwashed, the theory goes. He was actively looking for a totalistic organization that accommodated his polarized personality. Some incidents in Prince's background support this hypothesis. Although his upbringing was tumultuous, his mother died when he was 10, Prince maintained close and loving relationships with his father and his three younger siblings. After his mother died, however, he began experiencing bouts of total body paralysis accompanied by a sense of falling, like jumping off the Grand Canyon. The feeling was of helpless, abject terror. Then, suddenly, he would be outside his body, as if a parachute had opened, and he could observe himself sleeping in his bed. The intensity of these experiences made them absolutely real to him, but he decided not to talk about them because if you bring that up, you go to the crazy house. Prince now sees those episodes of body paralysis as severe anxiety attacks, but they prepared him to accept the truthfulness of the paranormal powers that Scientology claimed to provide. Brainwashing theory, on the other hand, proposes that strenuous influence techniques can overwhelm and actually convert an individual to a wholly different perspective, regardless of his background or pre-existing character traits, almost like an addiction to a powerful drug can create an overpowering dependency that can transform an otherwise stable personality. Stripping away a person's prior convictions leaves him hungry for new ones. Through endless rounds of confession and the constant, disarmingly unpredictable fluctuations between leniency and assault, love and castigation, the individual is broken loose from his previous identity and made into a valued and trusted member of the group. To keep alienated members in the fold, exit costs, such as financial penalties, physical threats, and the loss of community, make the prospect of leaving more painful than staying. Whether Prince was brainwashed, as he believes, or spiritually enlightened, as the church would have it, his thinking did change over the year and a half he spent in the RPF. In order to move out of the RPF, a member has to have a cognition that he is a suppressive person. Only then can he begin to deal with the crimes that he committed that caused him to be confined to the RPF in the first place. During his many hours of auditing, Prince later related, you just kind of get sprinkles of little things that seem interesting, sprinkles of something that's insightful. And then you're constantly audited and in a highly suggestible state, like being pulled along very slightly to the point where now I might as well just be here and see what this is about now. Maybe it's not so bad, you know? One of Jesse Prince's companions in RPF was Spanky Taylor, an old friend of Paul Haggis's from his early days in Scientology. She had become close to Paul and Diane soon after they arrived in Los Angeles. She called him Paulie and had helped him market some of his early scripts when he was still trying to break out of cartoons. From the beginning, she had seen his talent. Her own talent was helping others realize theirs. Spanky was a schoolyard nickname for Sylvia, but it had such a teasing twist that she could never escape it. She was the child of Mexican-American laborers in San Jose. When she was 14, she became a fan of a local cover band called People, which included several Scientologists. She began helping the group with concert promotion, and soon she was working with some of the other great bands coming out of the Bay Area, such as Creedence Clearwater Revival and Big Brother and the Holding Company. Scientology was just another expression of the political and cultural upheaval of the times. Even members of the Grateful Dead were drawn into Scientology, which promised mystical experiences without hallucinogens. Albert Ribisi, the keyboard player for People, introduced Spanky to the church. She joined the staff at the Santa Clara Mission when she was 15. She was a cheerful young woman with warm brown eyes who called everyone honey. Because of her experience with promotion, she was posted to the Celebrity Center. The place was constantly buzzing with activity, tie-dyeing, fencing, poetry readings, and she loved it. Famous people were always passing through, which added to the sense that something fun and important was happening here. Spanky inevitably came to the notice of Yvonne Gillam, who had created the Celebrity Center in 1969 after gaining Hubbard's permission to go to L.A. and escape the tension of his romantic pursuit of her. Gillam came to look upon Spanky almost as an extension of herself, with the same easy, natural flair for dealing with people. Even though Spanky was still a teenager, Gillam arranged for her to take care of some of the most important figures associated with the church. One celebrity quickly took precedence. John Travolta was in Mexico making his first film, The Devil's Reign, a cheap horror movie starring Ernest Borgnine and William Shatner. He got to be friends with Joan Prather, a promising young actress and dancer who was one of the few cast members his age. "He glommed onto me from day one," she said. "He was extremely unhappy and not doing well." Prather began talking about how much Scientology had helped her. Actors are often asked to get in touch with feelings that can be quite devastating. Dianetics offered a tool to get to one's raw emotions without going completely bonkers, she observed. "It sounded really interesting, so I brought up certain things about my case and asked if that could be handled," Travolta later recalled. "And she said it could. I said, 'Come on, could that be handled? You know, I couldn't believe it.'" Prather gave him a copy of Dianetics. It helped with his bouts of depression and insomnia. "Sometimes people say the most incredible things in the world to me that last year would make me suicidal," he observed. On another occasion, he remarked, "Before Dianetics, if people said negative things to me or about me, I would cave in easily. Being a man, that wasn't a very appealing quality. Some people would say, 'The boy is too sensitive.' But many times I had suppressive people around me who would cave me in on purpose. I was sort of like a minefield." Prather also counseled him using some of the basic processes of Scientology. "I went outside my body," Travolta later said. "It was like the body was sort of on its own, and I was outside, walking round it. I got real frightened, and she said, 'Oh my goodness, you've gone exterior.'" When he returned to Los Angeles, Travolta began taking the Hubbard Qualified Scientologist course at the Celebrity Center with about 150 other students. He confided to the teacher, Sandy Kent, that he was about to audition for a television show, Welcome Back, Cotter. After roll call, Kent instructed everyone to point in the direction of ABC Studios and telepathically communicate the instruction, "We want John Travolta for the part." At the next meeting, Travolta revealed that he had gotten the role of Vinnie Barbarino, the part that would soon make him famous. "My career immediately took off," Travolta boasted in a church publication. "I would say Scientology put me in the big time." Gillum adored Travolta and constantly told him he was going to be a star. To prove it, she gave him Spanky. Although Travolta craved fame, he was taken aback by the clamor that came along with it. Spanky managed his relationship with his fans. She went to the tapings of his television show, accompanied him to his many public appearances, and persuaded Paramount Pictures to buy a large block of Scientology auditing for his birthday. She was his liaison with the church, in Scientology language, his terminal, any person who receives, relays, or sends communications. She also became a conduit between the rising young star and other Scientologists in the industry, such as Paul Haggis, who gave Spanky a spec script for Welcome Back, Cotter, to pass on to Travolta. It was never made. Travolta generously credited the church for advancing his career and giving him the poise to handle his burgeoning celebrity. "You always have the fear, success is terrific now, but will it last forever?" he observed in one interview. "When you hit it quickly, you don't know where it will go. Scientology makes it all a lot saner." He introduced a number of fellow actors to Scientology, including Forrest Whitaker, Tom Berenger, and Patrick Swayze, as well as the great Russian dancer Mikhail Baryshnikov. Travolta's friend Priscilla Presley was the only one who actually stuck with the church. Spanky Taylor was a visible reminder of Travolta's increasing devotion to Scientology, as well as the church's investment in his fame, which could be jeopardized by the indiscreet behavior of a talented but entitled movie star. When the FBI raid on the Church of Scientology took place on July 8, 1977, Taylor was 6 months pregnant and living with her husband, Norman, in the squalid Wilcox Hotel. Norm was an executive in the legal bureau. Early on the morning of the raid, he frantically called Spanky and told her to get over to Yvonne's office right away to get the loaded gun she had been given by a friend, which she kept in her desk. By the time Taylor arrived, there were FBI agents everywhere, more than 150 of them at two Scientology buildings, the Advanced Org and Chateau Elysee. It was the largest FBI raid in history, and it went on all day and night. They brought battering rams and sledgehammers to break the locks and knock down walls. In addition to the 200,000 documents they were carting off, many of them purloined by Guardian's office operatives from government workplaces, they found burglar tools and eavesdropping equipment. Taylor dutifully made her way through the chaos to Yvonne's office and slipped the gun into her purse. She didn't allow herself to think how crazy it was to be carrying a weapon past all these lawmen. Outside the gates, reporters were clamoring to get in. Just then, a school bus pulled up, full of kids from a religion class at the Pacific Palisades High School. Taylor recalled with alarm that they were coming to take a tour that she had previously arranged. The wide-eyed teens watched as Taylor explained to the teacher that this wasn't the best time for the tour. They never rescheduled. Within the church, the explanation for the raid was that some Scientologists were being charged with stealing the Xerox paper they used when they had copied the reports on the church in government files. In other words, it was just another example of jackbooted government goons twisting the Constitution in order to crack down on religious freedom. But when the indictments came out the following year, the scale of Operation Snow White was plainly exposed. 11 Scientology executives, including Mary Sue Hubbard, were indicted in Operation Snow White. Her husband was named as an unindicted co-conspirator, although it had arisen from his original plan. Saturday Night Fever premiered at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood in December. Travolta had spent 5 months training for the film, running 2 miles a day and dancing 3 hours a night. He recognized the opportunity that the film provided, and he supplied a singular, electrifying performance. But when he walked down the red carpet, past the fusillade of camera flashes, he looked dazed. "When I got out of the limo in front of Grauman's, I was dumbfounded. I didn't know how to take it," he said in a televised interview at the after party. "It was like a fantasy. It was like a dream tonight." He was 23 years old, now an international star. He was also the most conspicuous Scientologist in the world, after only L. Ron Hubbard himself. And who is to say that Scientology didn't help make his dreams come true? Yvonne Gillam had fallen ill. She complained of headaches and was losing weight. She wanted desperately to go to FLAG, where she could get the upper-level auditing she thought could cure her, but she was told there wasn't money for that. Instead, she was sent on a mission to Mexico with her husband, Heber Jentsch, an actor and musician who later became president of the church, a largely ceremonial post. They had married 5 years earlier. On her 50th birthday, October 20, 1977, while still in Mexico, Yvonne suffered a stroke. Jentsch sent her back to Los Angeles while he completed the tour. After that, her daughter, Janice, one of Hubbard's original messengers, received a beautiful suitcase from her. Inside there was a letter, but it made no sense. Janice tried to find out what was wrong, but no one would say. Her sister Terry went to the Sea Org birthing and found Yvonne lying in her room, unattended. Finally, she was sent to a hospital where doctors found a tumor in her brain, which had caused the stroke in the first place. "It would have been operable if she had come to them sooner," the doctors said. Desperate to get Gillam the auditing she still thought she needed, Taylor went to the financial banking officer and begged her for the funds to send her friend to FLAG.
"If she wants to go to FLAG, she can take the fucking Greyhound," the officer responded.
"You're Yvonne's assassin," Taylor shouted. For her impertinence, Taylor was sentenced to RPF. Her new baby daughter, Vanessa, was taken away and placed in the Child Care Org, the Scientology nursery. There were 30 infants crammed into a small apartment with wall-to-wall cribs, with one nanny for every 12 children. It was dark and dank, and the children were rarely, if ever, taken outside. When she got the news, Taylor cried, "You can't do that now!" She was thinking of Travolta. He had just called her the day before, saying that he was arriving on an Air France flight after his appearance at a film festival in Deauville, where he was promoting Saturday Night Fever. Despite his triumph, Travolta appeared depressed and withdrawn. During the filming of Saturday Night Fever, his girlfriend, Diana Hyland, had died in his arms. She was 2 decades older than he. She played his mother in a made-for-TV movie, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, and had already had a double mastectomy when they met. Their romance was doomed when her cancer recurred. Taylor had helped Travolta through that period of grief, but now his mother, the most important figure in his life, had also developed cancer. Travolta asked Taylor if she would pick him up at the airport. She promised him, "Wild horses wouldn't keep me from being there." The church officials now told Taylor that someone else would meet Travolta. Taylor knew the star would feel surprised and betrayed. He had come to rely on her, both as an unpaid assistant and for emotional support. He would immediately suspect that something terrible had happened and worry about her. Taylor was mortified to think that she would be the cause of his discomfort. The RPF had moved out of the basement up to the top floor of the old V-shaped building that formerly housed the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. Nearly 200 people were crammed by the dozen into old patient rooms in bunks stacked 3 high. Because of the overcrowding, Taylor was given a soggy mattress on the roof. It was cold. She could hear the traffic on Sunset Boulevard only a block away.
She had a view of the Hollywood Hills and the endless lights of the wakeful city, which was throbbing all around her. So many young people like her had been pulled into the matrix of Hollywood glamour and fame, even if they would never enjoy it themselves. And now here she was, in the heart of it, isolated, trapped, humiliated, an unnoticed speck on a rooftop. Who could believe that a person could be so lost in the middle of so much life? Moreover, she was pregnant again. It happened a few weeks after she entered RPF during a brief marital visit from her husband. There was no maternal care or any easing of the intensely physical work she was made to do with the other RPFers, as they called themselves. For 1 2-week stretch, they were putting in 30 hours at a stretch with only 3 hours off. Like everyone else, Taylor ate slop from a bucket, table scraps, or rice and beans. After 6 months on this diet, she still wasn't showing her pregnancy. Indeed, she was losing weight. She worried that she was going to lose the baby. A pair of missionaries came to see Taylor one day with a strange request. They were thinking about how to reward the RPFers for having done the renovations to the advanced org building, which were now almost complete. "We would like you to arrange a private screening of Saturday Night Fever," they told her. Of course, no one in the RPF had been able to see the movie, despite the fact that it was an international sensation. Getting to Travolta wasn't easy, however. He was now the top box office star in the world. Playboy called him America's newest sex symbol. The church hierarchy was worried that he was also drifting away from Scientology. A screening of his movie would underscore his commitment to the religion at a moment when that seemed in doubt. As the church's liaison to Travolta, Taylor was the obvious person to make the arrangements. "First of all, I can't use the phone," Taylor told the missionaries. "Secondly, I can't leave the building. Maybe you'd like a Beatles reunion while you're asking for that." "We just think you could take care of this," they replied. Taylor had to figure out a way to get a print of the film from Travolta without having to explain why she had failed to pick him up at the airport and then disappeared from his life for months without a word. A couple of days later, the missionaries arranged for her to use a payphone on one of the lower floors of the building. Taylor called Kate Edwards, Travolta's creative director at the time. "Spanky, where are you?" Edwards cried. Travolta and his production company had been looking for her frantically. "Honey, I can't really talk," Taylor said. She told Edwards that she was in the Los Angeles complex. "I've been specially selected to do a program that will help me," she explained vaguely. She said she had an urgent favor to ask, a print of the film. That was a problem. The movie was being shown around the world, and all the prints were out. The only one available was Travolta's personal copy, but Edwards said she would make the request. "Johnny said if you ever called and needed something, just do it," Edwards assured her. "You can't tell John about this call," Taylor said. "I'm going to have to tell him," Edwards replied. "I'm going to have to ask him to borrow it." The next time Taylor was allowed to call, Edwards told her that Travolta had agreed to loan Taylor the print under one condition, that he could see her. The missionaries conferred with their superiors. They decided that as long as Taylor got the print, she could meet Travolta for dinner on the Sunday night after the screening. Footnote: Travolta's attorney denies there was an agreement to visit Spanky in exchange for his personal copy of Saturday Night Fever. End footnote. Travolta followed up by sending flowers, which were delivered to Taylor in RPF. The screening took place on Saturday night in Scientology's Lebanon Hall. It was a high point for everyone, all the more so because it was followed by a disco dance. Across the country, similar dances were taking place, inspired by Travolta's passionate performance. Taylor wouldn't be a part of it, however. As soon as the movie was over and the credits were rolling, several Scientology executives, including Yvonne's former husband, Heber Jentsch, escorted Taylor to an office and told her to call Travolta and cancel their date for dinner the following night. "I can't do that," Taylor said. "There have been all sorts of efforts to recover him, and we can't let you get in the way of that," Jentsch told her. "Call him right now." "It's after midnight." Travolta was furious when he heard what she had to say. "We had a deal," he said. "I know. I'm sorry." "How could you do this?" he demanded. "How could you leave your baby?" For the first time in their relationship, he raised his voice. "My mother died and you weren't there." Taylor began to bawl so hard she couldn't speak. She recalled that Travolta was asking questions she couldn't answer, questions she had been afraid to pose herself. He seemed to know what she was going through. "Unless you killed somebody, which I don't think you did, there's no reason for you to be where you are," Travolta told her. He had never said an unkind word to her in their entire relationship, and his frankness was devastating. "I'm doing this so I can be better," Taylor sobbed, "so I can help you more." Meanwhile, Jentsch was jabbing his finger at her and mouthing the order to hang up the phone. She quickly said goodbye and set the phone in the cradle. Then she was escorted back to RPF.